just well, started.
I'm at your disposal, guys, and the idea is I'm here to try to answer your questions. So I hope you have some.
Yeah, I've got a list of questions, but what about other people? Maybe we can go through and see how many questions we do have.
So people... A couple,
okay.
Okay, Charlotte has a couple, JC?
I also have a couple, yeah.
Okay, good. That's four, and Paul's got 28.
So yes. I have two classes of question. One, like small, like you can probably just explain them very quickly, and they have two real biggies that are complicated.
Okay. Well, that's like six majors and then some small ones. Well, why don't you start, Paul? Maybe with a small one.
Yeah, I can. If I could just put the small ones in the chat, because maybe that's easy.
Okay.
They're just basically like, what is this? What is that? Like, what are adjacent items? What is implicit instruction? I was really confused about that. If you're instructing someone, then they know they're being instructed. I was confused about that. What is naturalistic SLA? What is perceptual saliency? And what is sensitivity to input? These are just kind of comprehension questions.
So let me just see the chat again. Oh, I've got it. Okay, can anybody, JC and Saraja, can you see Paul's questions in the chat area?
Yep.
Yeah, yes. Okay. So what are adjacent items? I need a bit of context here, Paul. What's that from?
So this is all from Long. So page 46.
Okay. Has everybody got the Bible with them?
Yeah, hold on. Let me just go down
to
the PDF.
Paul's referring us to page 46.
Okay. Well, could you give me a subheading reference, because it's on a Kindle, so the page numbers are off.
Ah, okay. So the subheading here is—it's quite a long subheading. It's E3. Implicit learning is still the default learning mechanism.
And yeah, that starts on page 43, right?
That's right, and it's one, two, three pages after that, three or four pages after that. So it's 46.
Okay.
And it's below the Nick Ellis quote. From 2005.
Yes.
And
that said, there is also some evidence that the ability of adults as opposed to young children to learn a language implicitly may be limited to adjacent items. Okay, so what they're referring to there is items in a text. So the idea is that really this is referring to collocation.
Okay,
so the idea is that it is supposed that you really, we have to go back a bit here, because as you know, Nick Ellis adopts a usage-based view of SLA. So Nick Ellis is part of the new, he's probably the most important spokesperson for a view of SLA which completely rejects Chomsky's idea of a universal grammar and rejects the idea of a generative approach, and says that SLA can be explained in a sort of statistical way in terms of frequency, basically, in the power law of and so on. So he says we don't need a special language learning device, language acquisition device, as Chomsky called it, in order to explain how people learn. We can do it by simply referring to the environment. There is enough linguistic input available in the environment to explain how people learn, and they learn in a very basic way, the way they learn anything, by statistical frequency. So what they'll learn first the things that are most salient and most frequent in the input. And then they'll have problems with things that are not very salient and not very frequent in the input. I personally, I don't agree with this view. It's gaining huge traction. It's becoming a really serious threat, challenge to Chomsky and kind of paradigm. Mike Long is very persuaded by some of Nick Ellis's work. And they're kind of, it's interesting the way that there's a lot of congruence now between Nick Ellis and Mike Long. Both of them have this idea. Nick Ellis's idea is sort of resetting the dial. And he thinks that's the purpose of explicit learning and explicit instruction. That what we do is by drawing attention to particular items in of the target language, not necessarily formal, not grammar sort of things, but also lexical and other parts of the phonetic parts of the language. So what the idea of explicit instruction in Nick Ellis's view is to draw attention to it so that one representation of it can be established in short-term memory and then transferred to long-term memory, after which the default mechanism of implicit learning takes over. That's a bit complicated. We can go into it more, but in fact, Long talks about it in this chapter, Paul, this chapter three that you're looking at, the psycholinguistic underpinning of cognitive interactions theory. So when he refers to these adjacent items, what he's referring to is things that are close together in the input, in a text, whether the text is written or spoken. So, and the research that's been done suggests that, as it says here, observational experimental studies show that adults remain capable of absorbing statistical regularities and possible sequences of sounds and syllables with unconscious tagging, blah, 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 with adjacent things, but not with things that are separated. I think normally the work done using concordances and corpora suggests something like five to the left and five to the right of the item concerned is considered adjacent. Just let's pause here and say hello to Sam and to
Sebastian. Hi, Jeff. Hi, sorry for coming late. Thank you. I managed to get the Zoom link.
Good yeah. to see you. And we've started by looking at a few clarification questions, let's call them, that Paul has put up on the chat. Can you see the chat column on the right? So mm-hmm. The first, can you see that, Sam?
Yeah.
And good. Okay. So we began with Paul's question, what are adjacent items? And I was explaining this, the term appears in chapter three of Long's book, SLA and TBLT. The chapter is about the cognitive interactionist theory of SLA that Mike Long goes along with. And I was explaining that it's to do with statistical usage-based view of SLA, where SLA is explained in terms of learners noticing patterns in the input without the need for any generative grammar, without the need of any explanation of, like Chomsky's, that we have an innate language acquisition device that helps us to understand the formal properties of the language. So, if you do away with that Chomskyan view and you adopt the usage-based connectionist view that is now becoming increasingly popular and of which Nick Ellis is probably the most important spokesperson, then the idea is that what learners will have trouble with that, Nick Ellis, this is the unfortunate thing here in a way is that there's Rod Ellis, who's probably more, or used to be anyway, more well known and has this huge tome on second language acquisition, this huge book that is best used as a doorstop, in my opinion, and awfully tedious. But in any case, we're not that guy, not Lord Ellis, who we must remind ourselves has a particular view of TBLT and also, of course, a particular view of explicit and implicit learning. So Rod Ellis is one thing. Nick Ellis is completely different. Nick Ellis is the new spokesperson of very important work he's doing, promoting his view of SLA, which is now becoming increasingly adopted by SLA theoreticians. As I just said, I don't buy it myself. So far, I don't think it explains what children know about language, and I don't think it's a particularly strong model. But in any case, another thing that's interesting about it is that whether you adopt Nick Ellis's view, this sort of usage-based view, which people like Thornbury, for example, Thornbury's actually more persuaded by Larson Freeman, which is even more doubtful, in my opinion. But in any case, what's interesting is that Nick Ellis, as I was saying, and Mike Long are converging. And it's interesting in Long's discussion of his cognitive interactionist theory that he doesn't actually go into it very much. He doesn't actually provide a theory of SLA. He rather avoids the big questions of does he have any allegiance to the idea of a generative or universal grammar? Does he think that there are some parts of the learning of an L2 that are, or language learning that is innate? He actually doesn't, which Nick Ellis denies. Nick Ellis's whole, the point of the connectionist, the usage-based theories is that there is no need to appeal to some language acquisition device. The environment has enough in it, coupled with fairly simple learning mechanisms based around the power law of frequency and other things like that, to produce, in order to explain what we learn about language. So what's interesting, though, is that they're converging. Long does not. You'll notice in chapter three, it's written in terms of problems and explanations. So he said the first problem is that purely incidental and implicit child learning is overwhelmingly successful, but adult learning is not. So, and then the second problem is blah, blah. So he doesn't actually, although he claims to, outline a theory of SLA. He restricts himself looking at problems, which is an excellent framework, in my opinion. The best framework is to look at things in terms of problems and theoretical solutions to them, which are hypotheses or theories. But he doesn't actually offer any. He doesn't, for example, confront the question of, well, how do children learn their first language? How do they know what they know, with the obvious the problem, the biggest question that usage-based theoreticians have to answer is the poverty of the stimulus.
Jeff, can I just interrupt? Yeah. I think we'll need to manage time a little bit here because
we've only got an
hour.
So that's adjacent dialogue. Let's go on. Let me tell my thanks very much. I'm sorry. Okay, so what is implicit instruction? Paul's quite right. It seems like counterintuitive to an oxymoron. If it's instructed, then it must be explicit. I quite agree that it does seem contradictory. What they're referring to, though, is essentially negative feedback. So indirect ways where you don't actually say, okay, today we're going to talk about the present perfect. It starts with the use of the verb to have plus the past, blah, blah, blah. That's what's explicit instruction. Implicit instruction is a bad, in my opinion, I wouldn't use the term, but it is used. And it refers to this punctual, the use of focus on forms. You know, Long's big distinction between focus on form without an S, which is what course books do and what PPP methodology does. Today we're going to look at the present perfect, for example, and focus on form, which is where you are focused on meaning, where you engage in tasks and communicative tasks where people are using the language for communicative purposes, but at particular points where there are problems emerge, where the learners either make mistakes or can't express themselves or don't understand. So at these particular moments where the focus is still on meaning, teachers make interventions through various forms of, give various forms of corrective feedback. The one that Long is particularly keen on is recasts. So if the student says, well, yesterday I go to Madrid, the teacher would intervene and say, you went to Madrid yesterday. That kind of thing is what we're talking about, what they're talking about when they refer to implicit instruction. Okay. What is naturalistic SLA? Yes, this is partly the a hangover from Krashen, who introduced the term of the natural approach. He and Terrell in the 1970s, early 80s. So what it means is acquiring second language through in a naturalistic way, meaning a non-classroom based, non-instructed base, by being either immersed in the community or temporarily or completely. For example, migrant workers who go to an English-speaking country such as the United States or Australia, learn the English in a naturalistic way. So that's the idea of naturalistic SLA, in a non-classroom, non-instructed setting. And now, what is perceptual saliency? This is a very important construct for Long and for Nick Ellis and for most SLA theoreticians. The idea is that it's a part features of the target language that stand out perceptually are perceptually salient. So, for example, to give an example of something, the problem here is really the parts of the language that are not perceptually salient. So for example, third person S is a classic example of something that is not perceptually salient. You don't notice it. And that's why, according to Nick Ellis and many others, I would agree here, incidentally, that's why it is late acquired. It doesn't make any difference to the meaning whether you say he go or he goes, and if you say he go, everybody will understand you. So it doesn't contribute anything, nor is it particularly salient perceptually in the way that, for example, certain phonetic features are very salient and certain are not. And one of the problems in English is that the schwa, for example, is not particularly perceptually salient, and so is hard for those languages, well, most any other languages, to get hold of. So the idea of perceptual saliency is easily noticed in the non-technical sense, not necessarily in Schmidt's sense of the word noticing, but in the everyday meaning of the word, that perceptually salient means that it is easily noticed by the senses. You can hear it, you can see it, and so on. You can read it, notice it in the text, and so on. So those are the features, according to Long, and Nick Ellis would agree, and so would the majority, incidentally, of scholars, to, regardless of whether they take a generative or usage-based view. This idea of perceptual saliency is very important for deciding what teachers, the implication is teachers should pay attention to non-salient features of the language, because those are the ones that the learner will not easily pick up in it through implicit learning. And that's the importance of them, that they point to the implication of them for teaching. It's interesting to notice that Long's chapter 3 is a cognitive interactions theory of ISLA, of instructed SLA. So he, and you know that he and Nick Ellis and one or two others formed a new journal a couple of years ago called Instructed Second Language Acquisition. So they're particularly interested in this area of SLA research. And in this area, the idea of saliency is extremely important, because it informs the question, what should teachers, what explicit teaching should we do? And one of the suggestions is that we should pay particular attention as teachers to helping students notice non-salient features of the target language. Okay, Neil, welcome Sebastian, welcome Sam. So those are some of Paul's little questions of clarification. Let's go quickly to one of the big questions that, Shaila, do you have a question? I can't hear, I think, here we are, yes.
Shaila's microphone's muted, so I don't know.
What's that?
If you can unmute your microphone.
Sorry,
microphone's
I was talking muted. And, I was on mute, sorry.
That's it, no worries.
Okay, so I had a question based on what you said earlier, Jeff, that was about, there are a number of researchers who are talking about a huge number of things, and they're all coming at it from different angles, and they're each saying something which is perhaps directly contradictory to the other. So what exactly is the theory for TBLT? That even there there's a lot of diversity in terms of opinion. So how do we know what is the right thing and what is not the right thing?
Yes, you're right. There are various forms of TBLT. Long suggests that there are weak forms, which he thinks don't count. Long dismisses these as using a product-based or a synthetic syllabus, where tasks are activities used for communicative practice. So within a framework of a synthetic syllabus, which chops up the language and presents it bit by bit in the way that course books do, for example, the tasks are inside that framework. And that's one view of TBLT, which Long and we reject for the reasons given about the limitations of a synthetic syllabus. very, very important for us to be clear about the difference between synthetic and analytic syllabuses. Other people refer to them as type A, type B, or as product, Breen says product and process. Long and Crooks, in their very important article in 1992, made the distinction between analytic and synthetic, but they redrew the boundary where Wilkins had made the original distinction, his functional notional syllabus. In any case, the basic difference between a synthetic and an analytic syllabus is a synthetic syllabus cuts the language up and then presents different bits of the language in a sequence. Okay, so today we'll do the present tense, then we'll do pronouns, then we'll do the comparative and the superlative, then we'll do the part and so on and so on. Or if it's a functional notional syllabus, we'll start with apologizing and so on. A analytic syllabus treats the language holistically, doesn't cut it up. Of course, the texts have to be carefully managed in terms of the level of proficiency of the learners. So you don't start beginner's level with authentic texts taken from newspapers, for example. But in any case, the idea of a synthetic syllabus is presenting and practicing the language. It's basically a sort of PPP methodology. You present it, then you practice it. And the idea is you go from explicit knowledge, you explain the language to people, and then that explicit knowledge is supposed to turn, which is known as declarative knowledge, is supposed to be turned into procedural knowledge, which allows fluent communication through enormous amounts of practice. Beginning with Krashen's distinction between learning and acquisition is between essentially explicit and implicit learning. One is conscious and one is unconscious. One leads to declarative knowledge and the other leads to procedural knowledge. After that, we now are in a position of three interface positions. The Krashen's distinction between acquisition and learning suggests that there are two different ways of learning, two different paths, two different cognitive processes, one to do with declarative knowledge and one to do with procedural knowledge, one to do with explicit knowledge and one to do with implicit knowledge. Now, if you grant, and it is generally accepted among SLA scholars that such is the case, that there are two channels, let's say, of learning, two ways of learning, from a cognitive point, so we're talking psycholinguistics here, not sociolinguistics. From that point of view, the question is, what is the relationship between the two? What is the relationship between explicit and implicit language learning and knowledge? And this is the interface between the two. Now, Krashen says there's almost none. The most important thing is implicit learning, is acquisition. Explicit language learning has a very minor role. Most people reject that, think that's too extreme. The strong interface position is held most famously by de Keyser. And de Keyser's view is based on what's called skills acquisition knowledge. So you treat language learning as skill learning. And you begin with declarative knowledge. And you say, this is how it works, explicitly. And then through practice, that becomes procedural knowledge. Now, most people would, particularly Long, and particularly Nick Ellis, from a usage-based point of view, reject that. They say, it doesn't work like that. And the evidence we have that it doesn't work like that is from interlanguage development. what all we know about the way learners go from the L1 to the L2, this process of interlanguage development, rejects or contradicts the view that you begin with declarative knowledge and move to procedural knowledge. It doesn't work like that. Learners don't do that. So to go back to the question of what does this say about TBLT, from an SLA, from a understanding of how people learn a language, if you accept the SLA evidence, research evidence for interlanguage development, then, as most do, this is there's great consensus. It doesn't matter the arguments about universal grammar and generative views, the usage-based views. If you accept the work on interlanguage development, then you will accept the view that language learning, L2 learning, is mostly a question of doing it, not talking about it. It has to be done. You learn it through doing it. It is implicit. You learn it without being able to articulate what you know. And if that's the case, then TBLT must begin with the task. And the importance of the task is thus central. In a weak version of TBLT, we treat the language from a synthetic syllabus point of view. In a strong version, Long's version, the version we're going to look at here in this course, the unit of analysis for a syllabus is a task. And a task is not seen in terms of its linguistic complexity, but its cognitive complexity. But in any case, what we begin with tasks, and we begin very importantly with Long, with a needs analysis that identifies target tasks. The typical needs analysis that you see in books on needs analysis for English for academic purposes, or English for business, or English for nursing, or English for whatever it is, typically looks at what kind of language you need. Is it likely that you'll be using a lot of conditionals and stuff like that? It's a linguistic analysis. But Long's analysis, his needs analysis, is a task, target task analysis. You analyze, you find out what the students of the course that you're designing need to do with the language. What do they need it? What are they going to do? What are the target tasks? Will they need it, for example, for presentations? Will they need it for negotiating? Will they need it, and so on? And in the book, as we'll see, Long shows different examples of this needs analysis. So a task-based language course that begins with a needs analysis, not a linguistic analysis, but a target task analysis. Why does it do that? Because it takes a particular view of how we learn the language. What is that view of how we learn a language? That view is that language learning is basically implicit, that the most important and fundamental part of language learning is implicit learning through doing. You learn by doing things in the language, not by being told about the language. There is a huge gap between knowing about the language and ability to use that language for communicative purposes. And we know this when we look at people who've studied French in English schools for 14 years and go to Paris and can't carry out the most fundamental conversation. So does that answer the question? Why are there different views of TBLT? Because there are different views of how we learn language. Long's view starts from the premise that we learn the language by doing it. And that's why Long's TBLT takes the form that it does. I think Neil is impatiently wanting to, well, we've got, you're on camera, Neil, so I thought
I know.
You were going to say, get on with it.
I'll just appear. I'll just appear when I think we should move on to another question. I'm just conscious of time.
Okay, Okay, let's take another question.
Well, Shaila, does that, I mean, it's a really good question, but obviously we have an opinion, don't we, Jeff, about which theory of SLA is most compelling, has the most, you know, evidence to back it up, is most consistent, and we believe that Long's TBLT, based on that, is therefore the best option. But obviously, you know, the debates that you mentioned remain, don't they? There are disagreements about that. And I guess one of the objectives of this course is to try to convince you as well, right, Jeff, that this view of language learning is mainly an implicit business that's well supported by having students do things with a language is in fact the right one.
Yes, I think this is the interesting thing, that although there is no complete theory of SLA, and there's no consensus even of the bits and pieces we've got, nobody knows exactly how it's done. But there is, as I say, there's mounting consensus, regardless of all the differences between and the contradictions among theories and hypotheses, there is absolute clear consensus that the basic way that we learn language is implicit. Krashen, for all the mistakes and the weaknesses of his theory, qua theory, as a theory it's terrible because it consists of hypotheses that can't be falsified, they're empty. But his basic grasp of the situation is now very generally accepted. The basic way we learn the languages is through doing it. It's implicit. And that's the problem with the current way of conducting ELT through course books, which spend most of the time talking about the language, a teacher talking about the language, instead of devoting most of the time for with giving students opportunities to talk in the language for communicative purposes, for doing tasks that are relevant to their needs.
Shaila,
I'm sorry. That's why I didn't give you the chance to answer Neil's question of what do you think?
Actually, I put it in the chat. Sorry, yeah, I put it in the chat box. So my thing is when students are so focused on the message, often what you recast or what you tell them just doesn't get through. So is there any value in these recasts then? Is the implicit learning probably is just the communication? Also, when we talk about perceptual, something being perceptually salient, if it's not salient, then is there any value? If communication is achieved, is there any value in correcting it at all?
Well,
they will pick it up along the way, right?
Yes. What you notice with interlanguage development, and there's a lot of research on this, of how learners develop, how their interlanguage, the interlanguage is there, is a construct which refers to the learner's current view, not that it's articulated, of what the language is. So the assumptions they make, it works like this. And that interlanguage idea of the second language develops. It gets better. It's often U-shaped. You know, they start, for example, with negation. They use don't, and then they kind of go backwards, and then they go forwards again. So we know a lot about the way that their language develops, how it approximates more to what with an L1 user's use of the target language. So in that, we notice that by themselves, without any correction, with those people, for example, who learn in a naturalistic setting, the same development is noticed in the way that they take on board new things, start using the auxiliary verb properly, start using doesn't and does and did and asking questions and so on. How their use of the language develops has nothing to do with instruction. So, but your question quite rightly is, yes, but what if they don't notice? You tell them it does, and then 2 minutes later they say don't. So, well, yes, that's precisely the point. What we really need to know is, what is the most efficacious way of helping them develop faster? They'll develop, but as with children and as with immersion people, the biggest role that we teachers can do is to speed up the development, and we can do that by explicit teaching. And your question is, when do you do that explicitation? Is recast enough? And these are good, obviously fundamental questions. They depend slightly on cultural factors, and I, you know, there's a lot to be said about this, and we're going to say a lot about it during the course. And what's right for you might not be, it might be different from what's right in another teaching context. And the fundamental question is we are not saying for a second that explicit instruction isn't important. The question is, what's the best way to do it? And how should it be done? And we begin with the premise that it should not be the primary focus of a syllabus or a classroom practice. Not that it should be ignored, absolutely not. It's really important because it can improve the rate. We can't interfere with the root of interlanguage development, but we can certainly help with the rate. We can speed it up, and that's what we should be doing. So, and through the course, when we look at it, we'll see that different people, Gilbert, for example, is much more interested in feedback, and so is Skian. Skian says instruction is very important, more important than Long or Nick Ellis. So these are all open questions. How much correction, how much input, how much explanation of grammar points or Lexus or collocation, whatever it is.
So that's the little question, Jeff. Just to say that we are there's a whole session on this. I don't want to not talk about it just now. But when we come to look at how tasks go in the classroom and what does the teacher do, just to say recasts are one of a number of options available to teachers to focus on form. But just also one of the things about recasts, I think the research shows that recasts are only kind of effective if that student is kind of ready to learn that particular form. And as Jeff talks about interlanguage development, we know that some things are learnable before others, and they're kind of, they go in a kind of sequence. So I'm just thinking of the great example of this, I always think, is question formation, which in English can be very complicated. And what course books tend to do, of course, is teach present simple question forms quite early on. And what we as teachers notice is that the students can, they master it to the extent they can do a gap fill. But when they come to doing communicative activities, they'll slip back into, let's say, incorrect. Well, we call it incorrect, but that's where they are with their interlanguage. They just can't form questions spontaneously yet. So we might recast question forms till we're blue in the face at that stage of their learning, but they're probably not going to, it's not going to have much impact, right? And so the timing of recasts or where a student is really important. And I think the research on recasts does show that they're most impactful, they're going to be most useful when a student is developmentally ready to develop that particular structure.
What Long says about this is that his idea of focus on forms addresses this question, because you talk about the language through recasts or through correction or whatever the thing you do at the moment when the student is trying to say something in that area. So it's not that you say, okay, it's Wednesday, time for the present perfect, or it's week three, time for conditional two. It's you respond to what is the meaningful communicative activity, task that the students are involved with. And that means it's more likely, it doesn't mean it's, but it means it's more likely to be developmentally, that the students are more likely to be developmentally ready for that focus on form. But yeah, Sebastian.
I'm wondering, how do you overcome extreme fossilization? I mean, you can go through recasts, getting them to notice, getting them to commutative, how to get them from declarative to procedural. I mean, I've got students who cannot seem to get over their grammatical errors, and it's hard them to get from, you know, to improve. How can I get solve issues with fossilization of interference of their first language?
Yes, fossilization, it's an unpopular term now. There's, you know, but it's very real. It's almost sort of politically incorrect to talk about fossilization, but it is plateauing or whatever, or, you know, just, I think what, one question here is exactly that. The problem of going from declarative to procedural knowledge. So you shouldn't, you know, it kind of suggests that declarative knowledge is a bad place to start. You know, there's a famous Irish guy, the guy stops at a guy in Ireland and says, excuse me, can you tell me the way to Tipperary? And the guy says, well, if I was going to Tipperary, I certainly wouldn't start from here. So it's the kind of same thing, you know, declarative knowledge, a lot of people, and there's a lot of evidence to support it, does not always transfer to procedural knowledge. Even with lots and lots and lots and lots of practice, they still don't get it for a variety of reasons. It obviously depends what bit it is, you know, and this is the question coming back to saliency and so on. What are the bits that they find hard? What are the bits that you do it till you're blue in the face and they still, and then the other bits they get just like that on the first go. So I think what this suggests, if you have a problem with fossilization, you know, they don't seem to be making any progress towards a more accurate use of forms, for example, then the question there is, it could be all sorts of things. It could be motivation. It could be affective factors. It could be, you know, they don't need to. They don't see the need, and so on and so on. And probably, my view would be, leave it alone. You know, don't bang your head against a wall. It suggests to me that the syllabus is not properly focused. In other words, it's trying to present stuff to people and they think that they'll get it. And I don't think that's the right way to go about a syllabus. But as fossilization, things like by Selinker, for example, Selinker's quite good on fossilization, and there are suggestions of how to get over these problems. Some of them are, if you bang away at it enough, there's evidence to suggest that they'll eventually get it. So if you've got enough time and patience, that's one way to go. But another way to go would be, more communicative practice. And that would be my suggestion. And it is the case that certainly some people, and which is why the needs analysis is so important, they don't need it. You know, and if they don't need it, like me, I've lived in Spain for, you know, longer than you walk the planet. And my Spanish is absolutely terrible. I mean, people can't believe how bad my...
He's gone.
I don't know if you... Frozen, Jeff. Oh. Well, let's hope Jeff can reconnect. Can I just moderate a little bit these last questions? And I've noticed that, Sam, you've asked a question about general groups. And what I'm going to do maybe is postpone that to the next session, because the next session we talk about types of TBLT, we do get onto this question about what about groups where students don't seem to share needs. And if you don't mind, maybe we'll deal with that in the next session.
Yeah.
So what are there any other questions? You've got a question as well about controlled practice. Any other questions about this cognitive interactionist theory particularly? And let's hope Jeff can reconnect and answer it, because he'll be better at it than me. Nothing in particular about it. So, Paul, did you have more? Because I know you said you had some short questions and then you had some...
Yeah, the big one was on page 50, Long writes about the role of intentional learning. And this is like a big thing that Jeff came across, talked about in his presentation. The role of intentional learning and his explicit knowledge is to modify entrenched automatic processing routines. And my question was, processing for what? You're processing in your brain for producing language or for understanding the input? Aren't these different processes? So you process things, I think, maybe differently when you won't need to speak from where you're just reading to yourself silently. So, I mean, isn't that a difference?
Okay, I think I'm not very well qualified. I think Jeff's more qualified to answer that. But since he's not here, the way I understand it is that when they refer to this processing, they're talking about, okay, you're processing input for meaning. And it relates to what Jeff said earlier about saliency. There are certain things that, like third person S, which don't, you know, not processing that there's an S there doesn't really impede our understanding of what's being communicated, right? And another example, I think, are ED past endings, that when the context is obvious, that someone says yesterday, we might not process those little endings. And I think the idea is that we want to get students to notice these, so that when they produce the language, that they, you know, they use it more accurately, right? Whether it's written or spoken. Written, I suppose, allows explicit understanding to come into play more, because people take longer to write stuff, and then, you know, they can think about, oh, I should put an ED on the end of this verb, right? But in spoken English, we often hear that learners, they just don't put it there. And it's one of these things that seems to come quite late in interlanguage development, if at all, right? If they don't reach that plateau. So the way I understand that bit is it's like your first language has kind of set parameters in your mind about how language works. And so when you're exposed to a new language, the things that are similar to your first language will be processed and noticed, right? So things like, if your word order is similar in your first language compared to the second, then you know what I mean. But other things won't be. So the purpose of explicit instruction there is to reset the dial. So as opposed to the synthetic approach that Jeff mentioned, where the purpose of explicit instruction is to generate declarative knowledge of something and then practice it so much that it becomes automatic. Here, the purpose of explicit instruction is to, I suppose, provide whatever processing units in your brain with information that actually there is something, there's a kind of morpheme at the end of that verb which shows its pastness. And that so later, when they hear input or read input, it's actually processed that's there. And that can become part of their implicit knowledge. So I don't know if I've explained that particularly well, but that's the way I understand it. It's about you process input for meaning, and you will using, you know, a kind of understanding of the grammar that's used to get that meaning. Some things just won't necessarily add much to your understanding of what's being said. And if they're not anything to do with how your first language works, they just might not become part of your implicit repertoire.
I mean, for me, I'm learning Serbian and they have a case system, and the case system blows my mind. So I can't get the endings for the words, because I'm like, in English, you'd never add a different letter onto the end of a word depending on the situation. So for me, my teacher recasts, I just don't get it, because it's like impossible for me as an English speaker to get that. But I can read it. I can understand it when I read it. I can process it, but I can't process it for output. That's my question. Is it different processing for comprehension than processing for output?
I think that's just too technical a question for me. Jeff's the SLA expert in this team, but the way I understand it is our processing for input affects what we produce, we can later produce. That if we don't process the fact that certain bits are there, certain endings, suffixes or whatever. I mean, if you you talk about, we talked about plateaus and fossilization earlier on. The things that become fossilized are good evidence of that, aren't they? They're just the things that haven't been processed, I don't think. I mean, articles are a good example. And we know that the English article system is pretty complicated. We can teach students all these crazy rules and categories and whatnot until we're blue in the face. But it seems to be one of the last things that ever gets learnt, if you like. And I think probably it's down to the difficulty of processing the input. So that's the role then in Long's theory of explicit instruction, is drawing attention to these things. I don't know, maybe we can deal, I think Sam had something relevant to that in the chat box. So you mentioned, there's more stuff here. Sam, what was it again about controlled practice?
Yeah. Am I audible right now?
Can you hear me? Yeah,
yeah, okay, cool. Well, it was just because I know controlled practice is usually a term thrown around with the kind of typical presentation practice production thing. Hmm. But like this morning, I was, you know, I had some students mid-task and an issue came up with the present perfect. So as I'm walking around and I realized that that was an issue for getting, you know, getting the communication right. So I was making notes of things, potential things to do kind of feedback on. Wasn't a recast because it was a big group, so it was more like something I will draw attention to on the board. So then I kind of pulled the example sentence up and did a mini explicit explanation, but it was based on the context of what we were working on. And so they all kind of got it. And then I wonder if at that point it's better to just go back into the next part of the task, or should I do something to reinforce that? Like some kind of practice, but then that feels too much like explicit grammar practice, and then we're back into the old kind of way of doing things. So that was my question.
I know what you mean. I think I know what Mike Long would say, and I think we've got an interview with him coming up in the course, but I think he says something along these lines. It's like, if you think that it's going to benefit your students, then go ahead and do it. Long's not very prescriptive when it comes to how we go about the explicit teaching. He's got his recommendations. He says, let's do recasts. Let's try and keep it within the flow of the communication. But he does say there may be instances where you need to pull back and do some more explicit focus on a structure. And if the kind of the expectations of the students are that you do a bit, you know, I mean, we don't always need to be going against our students' wishes in this. If you think and they think it might benefit them to do a kind of drill-like section where you try and get it in their heads, then why not, if you think that's going to benefit them? I don't think we know enough to completely dismiss that kind of teaching. I think what Long would caution, and think what we caution in general, is to not let that take over the lesson, and to get them back on task as quickly as possible, because the belief here is that the implicit processes are primary, and the more chance they get to use the language, getting feedback on it in that communicative way, the better. But just on a personal note, I occasionally do exactly what you said. I will occasionally pull away from the task, do a bit of explicit focus, and perhaps do a bit of controlled practice on something that I think might benefit the students. Yeah?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
We're not here to dictate how you go about teaching grammar. We're here to try to promote the idea that getting students on task as much as possible is really beneficial for them.
And in that case, the grammar still comes specifically from a communicative need in the task. So it's not something you've pre-decided that you need to teach. It's more like it kind of like in the dogma sense, where it arises as a need and then you attend to it. So.
But as we'll look at in the next session, in weaker, which is very pejorative, of course, I'm going to call them integrated versions of TBLT, where tasks are integrated into a structural syllabus. Then you do have focused, what are called focused tasks. That's what Rod Ellis calls focused tasks. They are communicative, but they're designed to promote practice of particular structure or structures. And in that kind of more integrated type of TBLT, you know, you do get that, you do get the kind of grammar dictating how the, you know, what the task is. It becomes like a kind of communicative practice of a structure. But that's the range of kind of TBLT options that we mentioned earlier. And it may be that, you know, if you're having to teach a structural syllabus, if you're in an institution where that happens, you can't go against the grain and ditch everything and do a purely task-based syllabus, then making those practice activities as communicative as possible so that students are not just practicing that structure, but getting all sorts of other kind of practice about turn-taking, about pragmatics, about whatever it is. Obviously, that's better than just doing drills, you would hope. Right? I think Jeff's lost, unfortunately, somewhere in cyberspace. We've gone over time, but I'm quite happy. If there are any burning questions that I might be able to answer to finish off, I'm happy to do so. But if not, time's up. So Thanks very much for the tutorial.
Thanks, Neil. Yeah.
Thanks, Neil.
Thank you.
It's been a lot covered, but at the end of this session, I will publish the recording so you can review stuff. And keep in touch. I can see the posts on the forum about the task. That's great. And once we've got a few more of these in, we'll have a little discussion in the forum about
it. Is there a solution? I couldn't find it. I didn't read. Oh, my God.
There's not a solution either.
The thing is, there is a solution. There's only one solution to this task that completely fulfills all the rules.
How? I like these damn Pierre. He only speaks Spanish.
He got stuck on him as well, yeah.
Well, that's part of it. I thought, because this is a very theory-heavy session, I thought it'd be nice to do something more practical in the forum task.
That's good.
And look at how... That task is a research task. It was actually devised, obviously not from a needs analysis, because, you know, having to seat people in very specific places, maybe wedding planners have to do this task. The task for wedding planners, right? But it was a task devised not from a needs analysis, but for research purposes, and to research how, if you have a task with only one solution, does that promote more interaction than a more open task in which perhaps various solutions are possible? So that's one of the things that we'll post about before the end of the session once a few more people, but I hope you found it interesting. Actually, I'm going to use it because I'm going to do some teacher training with Chinese students, so I have to change it. It can't be they're going to a Chinese restaurant, and I think I need to avoid the political side of it, so I'll make it, you know, you can't put engineers next to arts graduates or something like that. You know?
Yeah, that's better.
We'll adjust it like that.
They don't know what is right wing or left wing.
It'll be an Italian.
Chinese food, not PC these days.
Well, I don't think doing something with Chinese students where they are going to a Chinese restaurant, they might find it a bit strange that I specify as a Chinese. Maybe it's just
that's true.
It goes McDonald's.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a problem at all because we don't really prescribe places to people. So people just sit where they want. I don't know if it's the same in China. Well, do you assign places to people?
No, that's why it's a kind of funny task. That's why it's kind of it's odd. It's not based on any, I don't think, real need. But apart from, as I say, wedding planning, I think there sometimes people are quite, no, we can't have Uncle Tom sitting next to it will be a disaster, you know. Anyway, thanks very much. Sorry that Jeff dropped out.
All right.
But hopefully most of your questions were answered. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Yep. Thank you. Cool.
Thank
Have
you.
A nice
Bye,
day, everyone. Thank you. Very
Have
much.
A nice week, everybody. Bye,
Bye everyone.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.